I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule for Wednesday, April 17. A lot to get to today, including conversations about Rochester expansion and stadium funding. Also, some state lawmakers want more money. DFLers in Minneapolis talk about what they want in a mayor. And we'll hear about racial tensions heating up in a Hopkins high school. First, St. Paul's Regents Hospital is apologizing for mishandling a stillborn baby whose body was discovered in linens at a laundry service. The body found at a laundry service facility in Red Wing was that of a 22-week-old baby. The hospital says the remains had been wrapped in linens in its morgue and were mistaken for laundry. The hospital calls it a terrible mistake and says it is extending deep apologies to the family. They're offering support and counseling to employees of that Red Wing linen service. A state house committee is discussing a new plan to fund infrastructure improvements in Rochester. It's all part of the Mayo Clinic's plan to become a destination medical center. Mayo had asked the state to kick in $500 million as part of its $3 billion expansion. Key state lawmakers have said that's too much, and they want the city of Rochester and Olmsted County to provide a lot of it. Kathy Werzer discussed the latest with Rochester Mayor Ardell Brady this morning.
As you know, DFLers are saying that the local governments in this deal, Rochester, Olmsted County, need to have more skin in the game. What do you think of that?
Well, yeah, we've heard that from day one, but first of all, you know, we're just pleased that the Houses and the Senate, I think both, are recognizing how important this expansion of Mayo Clinic is, not only to Rochester, but indeed the entire state of Minnesota. I made the comment a while back, not that far back, but I said, you know, this is kind of our Super Bowl. And when I say our, I think it's really the state, you know. And at times, you know, if your game plan isn't maybe working the way it is and it's halftime, you better change. Otherwise, you may lose the game.
But usually, you know, when we talk about plans like this, though, local officials start sweating a little bit when they have to raise taxes. And it appears the city of Rochester would need to raise about $128 million in local taxes to help pay for the infrastructure improvements and the like.
And that is concerning. But at the same time, they've given us some options, too, as to what we could do. And yes, some of that does say raise taxes, or another way to put it, some of them, it's to continue. One of the things that seems to have some favor to it is the fact that we could extend our half-cent city sales tax. We raise about $10 million a year on that, and as growth occurs, that will go even higher. And so one of the options, and it's somewhat comparable apparently to what Bloomington was given for the Mall of America. There's several things, you know, whether you can do a TIF district, you can do tax abatements, but our sales tax now, it looks like it would be about 13 years that we would have the 139. But if it were extended, and that's one of the options, that would go for another kind of 10 years or more, we would be able to, I think, do that.
What do you think residents in Rochester are going to think of this?
Well, I think, you know, anytime there's any hint of that or the reality that may occur. But I will go back again. Our sales tax this last time, we just passed it last November, it passed 2-1. And this is the first time that we actually had formal opposition to it. On top of it, I think the public here really knows the benefit of some of the taxes that we have. And so, yes, I expect that there would be those that will say, what are you guys thinking and doing? And some, we've already heard some say, well, can't Mayo just pay for some of those things?
What did you make of Mayo CEO's comments to the National Press Club that were not looked upon favorably by state lawmakers in the House, that testy House Tax Committee hearing last week, that, look, 49 other states would love to have us? Are you confident that Mayo will continue to have a big part of Rochester's life, Minnesota's life, or can they go somewhere else?
Well, they aren't going to move. I listened to the whole speech that Dr. Noseworthy gave, and yes, he made those comments, but he also said multiple times, we are not leaving, we don't want to leave. But the reality of it is, yes, there's places that would say, I mean, look, we had a legislator that said, why don't you move closer to the Edina? Even that.
Mayor Brady, I appreciate your time this morning.
Okay, well, thanks, Kathy.
Rochester Mayor Ardell Brady and Werzer on Morning Edition. Now, the state is still trying to figure out how it's going to pay for its commitment to build a new football stadium in downtown Minneapolis. The electronic pull tab games have struggled out of the gate, and lawmakers are trying to come up with a fix. Kathy talked about that with our Tim Nelson, who has followed the stadium funding plan from the start.
Let's cut to the big question here.
Okay.
Can the state count on gamblers to pay the mortgage on this new NFL stadium?
Well, as you know, this whole stadium deal is rested on an experiment. Minnesota's been the first to introduce these new electronic pull tabs and the gambling codes with them. The state is counting on taxing that to pay for the stadium. I've been doing a lot of reporting, as you know, on how those numbers aren't adding up. But the supporters of the plan are trying to make it work now, even if it means changing the rules. The House Commerce Committee Chairman Joe Atkins handed out this 5-point plan. It's a one-pager at a meeting at the Capitol last night.
Okay, give me the highlights of that plan.
Well, the first thing, Atkins is thinking about dedicating some of the proceeds from these games to advertising and marketing because he thinks people still aren't aware of where these e-pull tabs can be played. They're only at about 200 locations right now. Second, he wants to offer some incentives, either financial or additional games, maybe exemptions from state fees or audits. Also, additional pull tab or bingo games for high-performing bars. The third thing, and this is the most controversial, he wants to separate the paper and electronic pull tab business. Right now, only places that have paper pull tabs can offer the electronic versions. That's right in the stadium legislation. But Atkins says there's places like chain restaurants that might be interested in these electronic games, but they don't want to deal with stocking the boxes of paper pull tabs and cleaning up the mess it sometimes makes. I should add that I've got his whole list up at our Stadium Watch blog at nprnews.org.
Okay, is any of this likely to happen?
Maybe. The Minnesota Gambling Control Board told me the charities right now are free to use gambling proceeds to advertise, but they don't want to do it because it comes out of the money they spend on what they call their mission, like youth hockey and Lions clubs and such. As for those extra machines, that's a whole different story. There was a limit on how many machines could be out there, set right into law last year, a maximum of a dozen per location. Now, that was set up after negotiations with tribal casino operators in return for them not fighting the new gambling for the stadium. The third thing, like I said, is separating the paper and electronics. It's going to be very controversial. Electronic pull tab gambling is likely to be cheaper and easier in the long run, but both lawmakers and charities don't want what's so far been about a $10 million e-pull tab business to kill off the state's billion-dollar paper pull tab industry. That brings in about $40 million a year in state taxes directly into the general fund now, and so they don't want to interrupt that.
Okay, so we have that over here. Let's talk a little bit about last week's plan, yet another plan. New stadium taxes, right? Would these changes be instead of a tax on jerseys or luxury suites?
Well, you're right. It's getting hard to keep track here without a program. The stadium plan does have a built-in backup. That's the state lottery and stadium taxes. The finances signed into law last year are really so out of whack that it's unlikely that that backup's going to be enough. So let's call that plan B.
Okay.
Okay, the new taxes on sports memorabilia and luxury suites for the Vikings, the Twins, the Wild, the Timberwolves, and the Lynx, that's plan C. Governor Dayton said yesterday his administration is doing the math on that right now to see if it's enough. So these proposed changes to pull tabs last night, they're plan D, so we're on to four here.
Okay.
And state officials are just working their way through the alphabet trying to come up with something that will pay $34 million a year. That's the mortgage the state has offered to pay for the new Viking Stadium. And state officials say they don't want it to fall on regular taxpayers in the end.
That's Tim Nelson and Kathy Werzer on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. The Minnesota Senate has passed a funding bill for state government agencies. It also includes pay raises for legislators and the governor beginning in 2015. It was a close vote, 34-32, with all of the Senate Republicans opposed. Tim Pugmire reports from the state capitol.
Senate Republicans raised several concerns about the omnibus state government veterans and military affairs budget bill, They objected to the elimination of a commission to end outmoded government agencies, a new auto theft prevention surcharge on insurance policies, and an allocation for a Forest History Center. But there were no complaints about the pay raises or any amendments to try to strike or adjust them. There was no discussion at all. Afterwards, Senate Republican Minority Leader David Hahn of Eden Prairie was asked if legislators deserve a raise.
I think it depends on who you talk to. I mean, a lot of legislators understand when they're elected what they get paid. I think the timing is a little difficult when people contemplate the kind of economy that we're in and circumstances people are going through. It's difficult, but I think most people I know don't believe that we're overpaid.
Hahn added that he would take the higher salary if it becomes law. Democrats also did not address the pay raise during the floor session, even though the recommendations came from a nonpartisan panel that studied government salaries, many of which have been static for 15 years. Under the bill, the governor's $120,000 salary would increase 3%. Legislators' salaries would then be set at 33% of the governor's salary, which would increase annually based on inflation. Members of the House and Senate would initially see their base pay go from about $31,000 to about $41,000. Current restrictions on the salaries of top agency officials would also be loosened. None of the changes could take effect until after the next election. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach of Cook said he was a little disappointed that there wasn't a bipartisan vote for the bill, because some Republicans had told him privately that they agreed with the raises. Bach said voting for a pay raise is never easy. He said the 34 senators who did showed great leadership for the institution.
This is not at all about somebody like me that's been around here for 20 years. This is about the next generation of people that come to the Senate and what kind of people are going to be able to recruit. Or is the future of the institution of the Senate going to be one where only retirees can come here to serve, or maybe only people that are exceptionally wealthy can come here to serve, or worse yet, maybe the only people that will be here someday are people that can't find a job anywhere else.
With the essential 34 votes in hand, Bach said he wasn't concerned that five recently elected DFL senators from swing districts voted against the state government finance bill. One of the Democrats, Senator Greg Clausen of Apple Valley, said his vote was all about the pay raise.
As a newly elected senator, I just didn't feel comfortable that it was at this time that I should be voting in favor of a pay raise for myself. As a public employee over the years, I've taken pay cuts many times as an educator, and at this point in time, coming out of recession, looking at being a first-term senator, I just didn't think it would be appropriate.
The House did not include pay raises in its state government budget bill, but Senator Bach said the Senate plans to fight hard for its position in conference committee negotiations. DFL Governor Mark Dayton supports the raises and said he believes legislators are terribly underpaid. He also knows firsthand the challenges posed by the current salary restrictions in hiring commissioners. But Dayton said if a raise comes his way while in office, he'd donate the money to charity.
Tim Pugmire in St. Paul. In Minneapolis, DFL activists want their next mayor to focus on revitalizing neighborhoods, keeping property taxes down, and improving economic prospects for minorities. Those themes emerged at the city's precinct caucuses last night. Curtis Gilbert attended.
Jesse Rothman had never been to a DFL caucus before, but he decided to spend his Tuesday night at Whittier International Elementary School because he says this year's mayoral election is important.
There's a lot of decisions that go on the local level that sort of fly under the radar. People pay attention to who becomes president, and they don't pay attention to who's making the budget for the city every year, and those decisions are hugely impactful on our lives.
This is the first open-seat mayor's race Minneapolis has seen in 20 years. Incumbent mayor R.T. Ryback is stepping down at the end of his third term, and there are at least half a dozen candidates vying to take his place. All but one of them are seeking the DFL endorsement in this Democratic stronghold. Rothman will be one of the delegates who decides this summer which candidate, if any, gets that endorsement. He wants the next mayor to bring more racial and economic equality to Minneapolis.
I think the major issue with our city is that we have huge disparities between rich and poor and people of color and white people. And I think that those disparities need to be reduced in a variety of ways, particularly in health and education and economic outcomes.
Rothman's preferred candidate is Betsy Hodges. She's one of three current city council members hoping to move into the mayor's office, along with Gary Schiff and Don Samuels. Former council member Jackie Cherryholmes and former Hennepin County Commissioner Mark Andrew are also seeking the DFL endorsement. Attorney Cam Winton isn't seeking the DFL or any party endorsement in his run for mayor. First-time DFL caucus goer Timothy Pixley turned out to support Schiff. He's a Minneapolis firefighter, and Schiff has pledged to grow the department. But Pixley says his number one issue is his property tax bill.
I've lived in my house for 8 years, and it has over doubled since I've lived at the house. And I don't get raises like that at work to kind of keep up with it, so I don't know how much longer I'll be able to live in Minneapolis.
Many people show up at caucuses supporting one of the candidates, but there are plenty of DFL regulars who are still uncommitted. Craig Peer, who lives in North Minneapolis, isn't crazy about any of the candidates, because almost all of them are current or former members of the city council.
I see very little money coming from the city into the north side. I see very little support for anything that the north side wants to do by itself. And therefore, I'm very disappointed so far in what I've seen from our city council.
Laura Sodebier also hasn't decided which candidate to support, and she predicts none of them will receive the necessary 60% to win endorsement at the party convention in June.
I just think there's so many people running, and they're all trying to stick it out, so I imagine it's just going to be a free-for-all at that convention.
But Sodebier says a long and fiercely fought convention also means DFL activists will get to learn a lot about where the candidates stand on the issues.
Curtis Gilbert in Minneapolis. Two Hopkins High School students face misdemeanor charges stemming from an incident with racial overtones. The students were involved in a confrontation with school administrators that police say turned physical. Tim Post says the students, who are African American, were protesting the school's handling of an incident where they say several white students mocked African American culture.
On February 13th, a group of white student athletes at Hopkins Senior High dressed up to celebrate their upcoming trip to a state ski meet. Some black students say the ski team members called it Ghetto Spirit Day. But one of the students who came up with the idea, whom NPR News has agreed not to name, says he and his teammates called it Rapper Day.
I just thought it was going to be fun with my friends and stuff, and I guess some people thought that it was a really big deal, and I think it got a little bit out of proportion.
Two African-American students complained to school administrators about how the white students were dressed. One of the two, a sophomore, says this is what he saw.
One of them were wearing, like basketball shorts, a tank top, you know, a do-rag. And mind you, these are all white students, you know?
Almost 70% of Hopkins Senior High students are white, about one-fifth are black. And here's what the other African-American student, a senior, spotted that day.
They dressed up, you know, like a gangster, basically. They were sagging, chinchilla coat with the chain, joint in the ear, you know, just mocking our culture, you know. Really how we reacted, we felt like it was modern-day blackfacing.
NPR is also not naming the two African-American students because they're minors and face criminal charges from an incident that occurred a few days later. School officials say they didn't know how the ski team members were dressed until late in the day, February 13th, too late for them to act. But the African-American students who made the complaint say they got the information to school officials closer to midday. The next day, the white students were off to their ski meet and wouldn't return until the following week, after a long President's Day weekend. In the meantime, several African-American students who were upset at what they saw as the school's lack of action made posters protesting the issue. Administrators took the posters down. Hopkins High School principal Patty Johnson says that's because the students didn't follow proper protocol.
Any signage that is put up in our school is brought to the office to be approved. It's stamped, and then we actually have specific student bulletin boards.
A day later, the two African-American students who first complained about how the student-athletes were dressed say they entered the assistant principal's office and tried to take the posters back. The Minnetonka police officer who works in the school was called to the office. Hopkins school officials say they can't talk about what happened in the office because of data privacy. But according to the police report, one of the African-American students put his hand on the officer's chest in an effort to push him out of the way and leave with the posters. That student was put into handcuffs. Both students were held briefly and then released to their parents. The two students admit the meeting was heated, but claim neither of them touched the officer. The African-American students were charged with improper conduct, a misdemeanor similar to disorderly conduct, and were suspended for 3 days. The following week, when the ski team members returned, they joined the two African-American students in a meeting in the principal's office. The white students said they were sorry and that their actions weren't intended to be racist. But the two African-American students who were suspended and are now required to pay a $50 fine or show up in court say the process was unfair.
Well, I feel like it was just watered down justice. Really, all the boys had to do, only consequence was them, was that meeting. And all we did was tell them how we felt. They apologized, and then they walked out.
Hopkins Assistant Superintendent Nick Lightfoot says the disciplinary actions aren't tied directly to the dispute over the posters. It's because of what happened in the assistant principal's office.
People might connect those, but they were distinctly different situations.
Hopkins school officials say since February, they've met with various groups at the high school, reminding them about the consequences of doing anything that can be seen as racially insensitive.
That's Tim Post. Governor Dayton continued his budget-selling swing with a meeting last night in Virginia, Minnesota. Dan Crocker was there.
This was Dayton's sixth town hall event. The Democratic governor was largely well-received by a crowd of about 100 in this DFL stronghold on the Iron Range. Many thanked him for his proposed increases in education and health care spending. Several people addressed the planned reroute of Highway 53 between Virginia and Eveleth. To make way for a taconite mine expansion, MnDOT is considering a route that would bypass the two towns. Virginia City Council member Charlie Barabeau opposes the move.
This would be totally devastating to local businesses, to the health and safety of the individuals that lived on the east end of the range.
Virginia officials prefer a much more expensive route with a new bridge across an abandoned iron ore pit. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Virginia.
The Minnesota Orchestra says it will go ahead with an independent analysis of its finances, even though there's no agreement with locked-out musicians on the scope of that study. Musicians have been requesting the study, saying they need it to make a response to a management contract offer. Management finally agreed to do the study in January, but Orchestra President Michael Henson says musicians now want a larger analysis than originally requested.
And unfortunately, you began to see those parameters expand to include an examination of our artistic decision-making process and the quality and the effectiveness of the board.
Locked out musicians reacted angrily to news. The Minnesota Orchestra is going ahead with its analysis. Musicians negotiator Tim Zavadil says players need more say on its parameters.
That would be the best way to go, to do it jointly. I'm sure if we did one, they would say, well, that's just one that the musicians did on their own. I don't know what our response will be when if they release this information.
Zavadil says musicians are also disappointed management canceled more concerts, those through May 12th. Flint Hills Resources has agreed to make several changes to a plan to expand capacity at its refinery in Rosemount. The company negotiated the changes with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and the Environmental Integrity Project. According to that agreement, Flint Hills will reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 52,000 metric tons per year, which is about a fifth of the total greenhouse gas emissions expected from the plant. Scott Strand of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy says attorneys wanted to work with Flint Hills while their plans were still in the early stages.
The further you go along in the process, that willingness to change goes down and those costs go up. We would have had the option of going all the way to the time that the PCA issued a draft permit and then doing comments and perhaps going a litigation route. Our judgment was that by engaging in this process early, we got what we could accomplish through that, maybe a little more, and certainly at, you know, reduced cost.
Construction on the $400 million upgrade at the Pine Bend Refinery is expected to start next year. The late spring is causing problems with livestock manure handling on farms in some parts of the state. Last weekend, there was a major manure spill in Fillmore County. We talked about that yesterday on the NPR News Update. Mark Stile reports. The spill occurred when a holding tank wall collapsed, allowing thousands of gallons of manure to rush out, with some reaching a nearby trout stream. State officials are also seeing problems with manure applied as fertilizer on fields. Some of the ground is still frozen, and rain or snowmelt can wash the manure off the land into lakes and streams. The MPCA's Forrest Peterson says one thing farmers can do to limit problems is to be careful where they spread manure.
We like producers at least to look at flatter fields so there's not as much slope for chance for runoff.
Peterson also says farmers should not apply manure within 300 feet of a stream, pond, or lake.
That's Mark Style cutting through the cow and bull manure in Worthington. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. Your Thursday news right here tomorrow.